A lot of self-described environmentalists don't vote.
We are calling them. We are texting them. We are canvassing them. We are mailing them. We are sending them digital advertisements.
A nonpartisan group doesn't care who environmentalists vote for. They just want to get them to the polls. I'm Carol Holsapple. That's coming up on the Allegheny Front. Also, what happens now that Congress let funding run out for a program that supported everything from national forests to neighborhood basketball courts?
It's the kids, too. You know, the kids need somewhere to come and play at.
And nurses are on the front lines of climate change and health.
It's important to us to be part of the solution.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Investigators are trying to see if an underground methane leak might have caused a home explosion Wednesday in Greene County. It sent three people to the hospital. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier has more.
The explosion happened after a man tried to light a stove in a home on Bowser Road in Morgan Township, said Cheryl Barnhart, a township supervisor.
I guess the young fellow was lighting a stove in his house, and there was a gas buildup that he wasn't aware of, and it just kind of blew his house up.
Barnhart says the man, his girlfriend, and a child were all life-flighted to a burn center in Pittsburgh, and the house was destroyed.
It's totally gone. Yeah, it just blew completely apart and everything burned up.
State and federal investigators are looking into whether methane from nearby gas or coal operations may have gotten into the house. A neighboring home was evacuated after investigators detected high gas levels there. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Lake Erie's harmful algae bloom season, the one that makes the surface of the water look like pea soup, is over for the year. And it wasn't as bad as scientists had expected. IdeaStream's Elizabeth Miller in Cleveland has the details.
This year's algae bloom was relatively mild, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, a 3.6 on the agency's bloom severity scale, compared to an 8 last year. The forecast in July predicted the bloom would be severe and significant. A 6. NOAA says the bloom started unusually early this year after Lake Erie started warming up in May. But a September storm created strong winds over Lake Erie that, quote, disrupted the bloom, and it was over by the first week of October. There were areas of green, paint-like scum on the waters of western Lake Erie, but nothing like last year's bloom that drew national coverage and hurt Lake Erie tourism. For Ohio Public Radio, I'm Elizabeth Miller.
Do you know your rights when it comes to the environment? Well, in Pennsylvania, there's a constitutional amendment that guarantees environmental rights to all of its citizens, whether they know it or not. State Impact reporter Marie Cusick produced a documentary that's airing on PBS stations about the amendment. It's called Generations to Come, Environmental Rights in Pennsylvania. For State Impact Pennsylvania's podcast, Energy Explained, Cusick spoke with the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier about the film.
So, Marie, I want you to just give us some background. What is the Environmental Rights Amendment, and where did it come from?
The Environmental Rights Amendment was amended into the state constitution in 1971 because Pennsylvania has this long history of exploiting its natural resources that's led to a lot of economic growth, but it's also led to a lot of pollution. So it was really in the midst of the 1970s era of environmental activism that the state constitution was changed. And this very powerful statement was added. It's Article 1, Section 27, and it declares that people have a right to clean water, pure air, and this is the public natural resources of the state are for the benefit of all people, including generations yet to come. So in the documentary, I ended up speaking to the amendment's author, Franklin Curry. He's now 82. He was a young man when this passed. And he said he really wanted to make the state government the trustee of the resources and the guardian of our environment because, as he feels, they were just really a party to all of this exploitation over the decades.
For 100 years after the Civil War, The state government of Pennsylvania was pretty much controlled by the railroad industry, the steel industry, and the coal industry. They were accomplices to this.
We're going to jump ahead to 2013, and the amendment becomes, you know, very relevant for a pretty prominent case. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, this was a case that was about natural gas drilling, which there'd been this huge surge of natural gas development in Pennsylvania's Marcellus Shale. So the legislature had passed a new law. It was called Act 13 that did all kinds of things to update Pennsylvania's oil and gas law. And among the changes the legislature made was this very controversial provision that basically eliminated zoning requirements for oil and gas companies. So we all know zoning, you can do certain things in certain areas and you can't do other things in other areas. But this basically said that oil and gas wells could be placed almost anywhere in the state, regardless of the zoning. So a group of citizens, an environmental group, and some local governments challenged several sections of the law, including that one. And one of the things they cited was, you know, this violates Pennsylvania's Environmental Rights Amendment. And pretty much everybody involved in the case was very surprised when the court agreed with that argument and said, yes, it does violate the Environmental Rights Amendment. And it was the first time the opinion came in late 2013 where a court had used the Environmental Rights Amendment to actually nullify parts of a state law. So some of those controversial provisions were actually struck down.
And you spoke with the former Supreme Court Judge Ron Castile, who was the author of that decision, and he was pretty adamant about why he thought that provision of the law was unconstitutional.
And that bill, that Act 13 bill, was a total capitulation to the oil and gas industry.
Yeah, he said he thought that the oil and gas industry just wrote the bill and handed it to the legislature. And he said zoning really matters. You know, if you want to build a garage or something in your backyard, you need to go through and look at the zoning. And you can't just do whatever you want, wherever you want.
What this did is it overturned all of that, those zoning laws. But if you wanted one of these gas wells, it allowed them to be placed almost anywhere, in essence.
So he said he was really concerned about the way the law was written. And he said, you know, this amendment had been on the books for 40 years, but nobody had really closely looked at it, and nobody had really interpreted it. And if you think about the other kinds of rights that we're used to as Americans, like our First Amendment rights to free speech, for example, I mean, we're still hashing out what that means centuries later. But this was kind of put on the books in the 70s and just not really closely paid attention to.
This decision represented a big victory for environmental groups and municipalities that wanted to restrict fracking in their districts through zoning. But in your reporting, what has been the fallout from this decision? Has it put a damper on drilling in certain areas, or is this just kind of something that the gas industry has figured out a way to work around?
I don't know that it's really put a damper on drilling. I think everyone, you know, beyond the gas industry, other folks and other people are still trying to figure out what the amendment means. So this is all still very dynamic and developing. The one thing to know is that actually a lot of the very rural areas where Marcellus development is taking place never had zoning to begin with. And then also whether they're, you know, drilling a lot or pulling back, it is sort of more dependent on the price of the resource and not so much on what a particular local government might do.
Marie Cusick talked with the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier about the documentary Generations Yet to Come, Environmental Rights in Pennsylvania. They spoke on the State Impact Pennsylvania podcast, Energy Explained. Episodes are online at State Impact Pennsylvania or wherever you listen to podcasts. And check your local PBS television listings for when the documentary airs. More severe storms, rising sea levels, and temperatures will affect all of us in one way or another. But children are uniquely vulnerable.
Climate change has a variety of psychological impacts. Extreme heat events, there's increases in child abuse, domestic violence.
Later on the Allegheny Front, climate change and kids' health. Stay tuned. a federal conservation program that's helped pay for neighborhood parks and big attractions like the Gettysburg Battlefield just expired. State Impact Pennsylvania's Amy Sisk looks at what's at stake if Congress doesn't reauthorize funding.
Larry Jackson spends so much time at Hunter Park that his basketball is a little flat.
I just come down here and shoot hoops, you know, in my spare time. It helped me ease my mind a lot.
This park in the Pittsburgh suburb of Wilkinsburg has basketball courts, a playground, and a walking trail, funded in part by a grant via the Land and Water Conservation Fund. The program distributes up to $900 million each year to conservation and recreation projects throughout the country, but it's in limbo right now. Despite bipartisan support for the program, Congress let it expire at the end of September. When I tell Jackson about this, he says he'd like to see the fund stick around.
I mean, absolutely, you know, because it's not just us, it's the kids too. You know, the kids need somewhere to come and play at.
The Land and Water Conservation Fund has existed since the 60s. It's doled out billions of dollars the federal government collects from offshore oil and gas royalties. The Pennsylvania Environmental Council recently mapped out all the projects funded in the state. I meet up with Senior Vice President John Walliser, who pulls up the map on his computer. It's covered in hundreds of dots.
It's a pretty wide-ranging fund that's used from everything, sort of the big-ticket items that you would think of, like helping protect Valley Forge, funding the Flight 93 Memorial, the Appalachian Trail.
And many local parks.
I realized that my neighborhood park was funded by it, so the same park where my kid 10 years ago was going down slides and on swings, and now his cross-country team runs races there. That's where their course is.
Congress can't agree on how to continue the program. Several bills would make the fund permanent. Not every lawmaker supports that idea, and some think they should prioritize the backlog of maintenance needs at national parks. Some years, much of the funding goes to federal conservation efforts, so the amount left for states fluctuates. One proposal would guarantee states a 40% cut. Pennsylvania's top conservation official, Cindy Adams-Dunn, is on board.
What we find is, as much as we all love to visit a national park, that might be something you know we do on a vacation, but what we can do after work or after school or on a weekend is usually, you know, a nearby park.
Dunn is secretary of the Department of Conservation and Natural Resources. Her agency uses the money each year for grants to state and community projects. Say you're a city recreation manager and the pool and baseball diamonds at a local park need an upgrade. You might apply for money from Dunn's agency.
At this stage of the grant process, communities are reaching out to our park and recreation advisors, and the signal they give to the communities on how likely they can get funded is really important.
The state plans to give out over $45 million in conservation grants this year. Much of it will come from state sources, but it includes nearly $6 million from the Land and Water Conservation Fund. That $6 million would be zero next year if the fund remains expired. Without it, competition increases for state dollars. Lindsay Dill with the Allegheny Land Trust says state money helps her group fundraise around preserving green spaces.
That makes it easier to go to those foundations and those individuals and say, we just need you for this piece. So if we're missing a bigger piece of that funding, it's going to be harder to close the deal.
To protect places like the Audubon Greenway, northwest of Pittsburgh, where she takes me on a hike.
You can see the sun is filtering through the trees and the colored leaves are starting to fall on the ground. And it's just a really nice shaded trail to enjoy some peace and quiet.
The Land Trust has preserved over 400 acres like this in the Sewickley Valley, but it's broken up into parcels. Dill's group would like to acquire more land to connect trails. They hope Congress renews the program soon so that projects like that don't get pushed years down the road. Amy Sisk, State Impact Pennsylvania.
So you might think that when people who care about things like conservation hear that Congress allowed funding for those programs to expire, it would motivate them to get out there and vote. But it turns out people who identify themselves as environmentalists actually have a terrible voting record. Nathaniel Stinnett is working to change that. He's the founder of a nonpartisan organization, Environmental Voter Project, which has done extensive polling to identify this problem. Now the group is focusing on Pennsylvania and five other states to get environmentalists to actually cast their ballots. On our latest Trump on Earth podcast, the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant spoke with Stinnett ahead of this year's midterm elections.
So do you have any idea how many people we're talking about, how many non-voter environmentalists are actually out there?
Yes, we actually have a very good idea. In the 2014 midterm elections, 15.78 million environmentalists didn't show up on election day. All of these people were already registered to vote. They just didn't walk out their door on election day. And in 2016, for the presidential election, it wasn't much better. 10.1 million already registered environmentalists even stayed home for the presidential election, an election that was decided by a mere 77,000 votes. It's actually an enormous opportunity for the environmental movement, because changing someone's mind about climate change or the environment is extraordinarily hard. But finding people who don't need to have their minds changed and just getting them out the door on election day, I won't claim that's easy, but it's a heck of a lot easier.
What happens when environmentalists don't vote?
There are enormous implications. And the obvious one is it impacts whom we elect. But I would say an even bigger implication is it directly impacts the policy that is made. Who you vote for is secret, but whether you vote or not is public record. And the first decision that any politician makes when they are running for office is they look at the public voter files and they say, okay, with our limited time and limited money, who are we going to talk to and who are we not going to talk to? And they never, ever, ever waste any time talking to people who don't vote. And I know that sounds cynical, but it's just arithmetic. Like it's quite literally how elections work. Either you go where the votes are or you don't get to be a politician anymore.
And so, our show is based out of Pennsylvania. Are there any races or issues you're focused on here?
Well, we don't focus on particular issues. We're really just trying to find non-voting and seldom voting environmentalists and trying to get them to vote. But I can tell you, in Pennsylvania, we have identified almost 600,000 already registered environmentalists who have such poor voting records that they are unlikely to show up on November 6th. And these are the people we are laser focused on. We are calling them, we are texting them, we are canvassing them, we are mailing them, we are sending them digital advertisements. And what's more, we're going to continue doing it on November 7th and November 8th and November 9th. You're not going to get rid of us. And the reason why is this. When you're trying to change someone's habits, every election presents an opportunity to turn them from a non-voter into a voter. And so we were even turning these non-voting environmentalists out last fall in municipal elections. We mobilized 70,000 environmentalists to vote in the Philadelphia district attorney's race. And that's not because DAs have anything to do with the environment. They don't. But any election presents an opportunity to start pushing people into the habit of becoming a better voter. And that is our true goal at the Environmental Voter Project. We are not some secret election winning strategy. Instead, our focus is on changing the electorate. We want to contact these non-voting and seldom voting environmentalists every time they have an election, even if it's for a library trustee or dog catcher, so that after 2, 3, 4 years, nobody will be able to run for any office without talking about these issues. That's our true goal.
Where do you get that number that 70, you mobilized 70,000 voters in a Philadelphia race?
Well, we know how many of these non-voting environmentalists we were targeting. So we were targeting 70,000 of them. We know from the randomized control trials that we submit our work to that we were solely responsible for creating 1,300 brand new voters in that election. Because, again, we could compare turnout in our control group to turnout in our treatment group. And we could show that our interventions, our calling and texting and canvassing, was solely responsible for an extra 1,300 voters. And what's so important about that, 2 months after that DA's race in Philly, voter files were updated. And at that point, everybody who was running for Congress or governor or Senate in Pennsylvania said, wow, look at these people who voted in the Philadelphia DA's race. I bet if they vote in an election like that, they're definitely going to vote in the November 6th, 2018 midterms. And at that point, these environmentalists whom we had pushed into the electorate became first-class citizens. Because at that point, all of these campaigns, all of these politicians, all of these policymakers started caring about them.
Nathaniel Stinnett is founder of the nonpartisan organization Environmental Voter Project. He spoke via Skype with the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant for the latest episode of our Trump on Earth podcast. You can hear more at trumponearth.org or wherever you get your podcasts. The latest UN climate report caused a lot of headlines and alarm. It warned that we have about a decade to make the changes necessary to stave off the worst impacts of climate change. Yet, when Stephanie Chalupka speaks to people all over the country about the health impacts of climate change, she says people seem surprised.
I think people think of climate change as sort of being about penguins and polar bears, not about people.
Chalupka is professor and associate dean at Worcester State University's nursing department and is visiting scientist at the Mid-Atlantic Center for Children's Health and the Environment at Georgetown University.
I think people are a lot more interested in the issue of climate change when they find out how it is already directly impacting their health.
One of Chalupka's areas of expertise is climate change and kids' health. She was in Pittsburgh recently to speak at a healthy school summit put on by the group Women for a Healthy Environment. And we sat down to talk.
What are the ways that climate change can impact the health of children?
Climate change itself will bring about worsening air quality, which places children at risk, particularly the traffic. Traffic-related air pollutants, ozone, fine particulate matter. Fine particles actually can penetrate very deeply into our lungs and cause very serious problems for children and older adults. The air pollution gets trapped. Trapped and therefore concentrated. Increased extreme weather events place children at risk too because they are displaced, exposed to traumatic events. In extreme events when they become climate refugees, as we've seen post many storms where they go to shelters, these are adverse childhood experiences for children that can have lifelong impacts. Increased range of disease vectors, for example, our changing climate has brought diseases to regions that never experienced them before because of the earlier spring and later winter, so the growing season or the season during which these organisms can reproduce and multiply, bring us West Nile virus, Lyme disease to areas that never experienced Lyme disease before. If you look at the map of Lyme disease prevalence in the United States in the year 2000 versus the year 2017, if you go on the CDC website, you'll see some really startling data in terms of how it has just moved across the country. We are actually seeing more severe storms, and this is increasing flooding. We're seeing school buildings, we're seeing homes flooded and bringing mold and a variety of other risks, including waterborne diseases. As we have these extreme events and we have flooding, we have penetration into drinking water supplies, not only of biologic or microorganisms, but chemicals as industrial storage facilities or manufacturing facilities, storage sites, Superfund sites, as these get flooded and carry toxins to what would be potable drinking water.
And say a little bit more about the psychological impacts of climate change, because I know that's something that you've published on.
Yes, climate change has a variety of psychological impacts. First of all, extreme heat events. We know that there's increases in child abuse, domestic violence. We see increases in issues with those that have pre-existing mental health conditions because they are taking frequently medications that make them more susceptible to extreme heat events. We also see increased suicide. We see a variety of negative psychological outcomes associated with those extreme heat events.
And how are children uniquely susceptible to these risks?
Children are uniquely susceptible because they depend on adults. They have immature respiratory systems, so as climate change brings us worsening air pollution, they are much more significantly at risk, not just those that have asthma, although certainly that will have a big impact on them. They are more at risk for, I spoke earlier about potable drinking water and biological contamination for drinking water. Those at either end of the spectrum, either very young or very old, are particularly at risk for those things. Children are more at risk because of their behaviors for those disease vectors, you know, Lyme disease, West Nile virus, because they spend more time outside and engage in different behaviors than adults. So almost every adverse health outcome that we see in adults related to climate change is actually magnified with children.
Are these impacts happening now? Are we seeing them now?
Yes, absolutely we are seeing them now. 20 years ago, we thought that it would be very realistic that we would be seeing in our own lifetime the health impacts of climate change. But these are already being seen. I mean, just look at the wildfires, the Carr wildfire, look at what happened in California this year, but it really wasn't just California. That's what we're most aware of. There were outbreaks of wildfires in Scandinavia and Siberia. This is very serious and it's happening now. I work largely with children with asthma, and we are definitely seeing increases related to poor air quality days, which are increasing related to global climate change.
What role do nurses play in addressing climate change and its health impacts in their patients?
Part of what we do is health promotion and disease prevention. We work with individuals, we work with families, and we work as part of healthcare delivery systems. We're no longer really in the phase where we can put all our hopes in stopping climate change. We need to start working on resilience and adaptation first, which is, you know, an effort to help people to respond. So helping with community shelters, cooling stations, helping to prepare communities to be resilient in the face of extreme weather events.
So nurses are kind of on the front lines.
Absolutely. We are on the front line. Nurses sort of are the foot soldiers of public health because there are over 3 million of us. So we have the opportunity to make an impact. And many of the things that we try to teach people about in terms of addressing climate change have important co-benefits. To tell people bicycle and walk instead of, you know, take your car where it's possible. Eat less red meat. All of these are actually healthy for us as individuals. It's incumbent upon us to be a voice for our community because we understand intimately the connection between climate and health, and to advocate for policy solutions, because it is great to change our individual behaviors. Though we can't underestimate the importance of our own individual contributions, but the only way forward is policy and large-scale action, because there's no way out of this except for working together at a higher level.
Stephanie Chalupka is professor and associate dean of Worcester State University's nursing department and is visiting scientist at the Mid-Atlantic Center for Children's Health and the Environment at Georgetown University. There's more about her work at AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsoppel.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.